Hello and good evening, I'm Hafiz Marzuki. You are watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider the news of the day. As you all know, this is the election season for GE15, and in this particular edition, it is the most closely contested ever in the history of Malaysia. So how does one party or one coalition stand out in the face of many political parties? I have with me tonight Nick Nazmi Nick Ahmad. He is, of course, the Keadilan Vice President and also the incumbent MP for Setiawangsa. Thank you so much, Nick Nazmi. How should I address you? Maybe saudara? Is that okay?
Yeah, saudara is fine.
All right, thanks for being with us tonight. As we all know, I'll get this question out of the way first. We all know about the mood among the voters, and especially I'm sure Pakatan Harapan themselves have been saying that this is not the right time to do an election. However, it is happening anyways. And recently, Pakatan Harapan has announced that for all its state administrations, there will be no dissolution of the state assemblies. Of course, we know the intention behind this particular decision. But is Pakatan or Keadilan worried about the unintended consequences, especially when we talk about state elections, whether it's next year or further down the road, how it will affect voter sentiment, maybe a reduced majority? What's your comment on that?
I think the priority is about the situation on the ground, the floods, the rain that's happening. We're already seeing some floods coming up. And in my area, for example, because we are more in the hilly area, the same time when most of Klang Valley was covered with floods last year, last December, we also experienced landslides. So I think that's our concern, you know. So regarding turnout, regarding whether people are angry or whatnot, obviously it's important. I mean, we are politicians after all, but we have to put the interest of the public first. And I think since we were talking, we were pressuring the government not to do elections during this period. We decided, you know, eventually there was some there was a long discussion, as you are aware of, but we decided, we concluded that for the Pakatan Harapan states, that we will not dissolve together with the federal government. We'll try to go to the end of the term, and then you also have the PAS states taking a similar position. Okay. And I think it's more defensible this time because there are many other states. Normally, it's just Sarawak that do not have elections at the same time as the federal one. But now you have many other states that are not doing at the same time. So I think, you know, it's something that it's justifiable to do.
Yes. So moving on, as I said earlier in my first question, it's about voter apathy, right? How does Keadilan and Pakatan Harapan aim to overcome this particular, because I'm sure the coalition's main concern is, you know, making sure a high voter turnout. So, what was the strategy taken by the coalition?
We saw well, whether it was voter apathy or because people had to work or whatnot, but we saw that this problem was quite serious in Melaka and Johor, and we believe, because if you look, the UMNO vote was intact; it did not actually increase in the two states, right? But we believe that it disproportionately affected the Pakatan Harapan support. This time around, I did see some voter apathy, say 6-7 months ago. But we've seen, you know, since, you know, we've seen a change of leadership in DAP. We've seen the renewal process in Keadilan, with Rafizi, Nurul Izzah, myself, Amiruddin, Chang Li Kang, and so on and so forth, being into the leadership roles, we see that there's better interest from the voters. So the momentum is building up. So I think, we might see, that the turnout can be quite good in this coming elections.
Okay. So where are the areas that Keadilan and Pakatan Harapan aim to win? And of course, areas here, I'm referring to segment of voters. Because as you all know, I mean, in the previous election, the manifesto has been, offered. What are the issues that will be put forth by the coalition in order to attract voters? Because as you all know, I think the landscape has totally changed this time around.
You know, Pakatan Harapan is a national coalition. So, I mean, our strength has always been the urban areas, the middle classes, but also parts of the working class voters. where we lack and where we need to do better is in the Malay belt. I'm given the task of leading Keadilan Terengganu and Keadilan Kelantan, which is a tough task since not only Keadilan but PH has no seats whatsoever in those states. But you know, we need to break into those states because that's the only way we can talk about Putrajaya. You know, if you just talk about the urban areas, then you know you are not going to change the government in Malaysia. So we need to find ways to reach out to them. You know, it's not that we change our identity. Pakatan Harapan will always be multiracial. It will always be progressive, moderate, but there are also ways of communicating to the ground that maybe will get a better result as opposed to what we've done before.
In relation to the manifesto, I remember reading myself Buku Harapan, there are a lot of measures that were underlying there. And that particular time, voters are a bit, I wouldn't say unaware or mystified because they've never experienced a Pakatan Harapan government. And now that they have, I'm sure there are sense of reality and a bit of skepticism set in. How do you intend to counter this particular round in terms of what are you the coalition is going to underline in their manifesto this time around?
Overall, the manifesto was actually, I think, we did achieve quite a bit, 70%, you know, 22 months.
Short time,
you know, and I think that was a big achievement. I think the major problem was the fact that our leaders rubbished our manifesto, including Tun Mahathir, you know, when he said that it's not a holy book. So going forward, you know, we do intend to come up with a slimmer manifesto. It has to be more realistic overall, but there has to be 5 or 6 radical policies that underpin it, that address the difficult situation that we are in post-COVID, you know, because the economy is very vulnerable right now. At the same time, people are also very wary of the unstable political situation. And people still see the cancer of corruption so pervasive in society. So we need to address all these three items. And I think if we do so, then we are able to convince the public that you know, this manifesto can be delivered. And you know, so at the end of the day, I'm a Liverpool fan, right? And I remember Klopp, you know, he always said from the beginning he wanted to turn doubters to believers.
Wow.
And I think that's the task.
There's a powerful quote there.
That's the task that we on the PH side have in terms of selling our manifesto when we talk to the voters out there.
Okay, talking about turning doubters to believers, and I took note of your, I would say, the unenviable task of leading Keadilan in Kelantan and Terengganu. But I'd like to shift our attention to Sabah and Sarawak, because as we know, just looking at the previous territory election or state elections, Sarawak elections and also Sabah elections, Keadilan and Pakatan Harapan didn't do necessarily well. Will there be a shift in strategy in terms of the offering? How do you counter this rising regionalism that is being put out by the respective state governments? What will be on offer for these particular two territories, Sabah and Sarawak?
Well, we spoke to our when we drafted the manifesto, we spoke to our leaders in Sarawak, our leaders in Sabah, not just from APCO, which is a Sabah-based party, and a component of PH, but also with the PH, the other Amanah, Keadilan and DAP components in those two states. And, you know, we do have to address the desire, the sense of injustice that many Sabahans and Sarawakians feel. But we also, you know, I think we need to show that we're different, because there are also those who talk about regionalism, but then they take that as a blank check for their own corruption to happen, you know, and I don't think that's what Sabahans and Sarawakians want. So, but I agree. I mean, it's because the sad part of it is that Keadilan, if you're talking about Keadilan, our second biggest membership is actually in Sabah, after Selangor, okay? And Sarawak is also where we've produced not just Chinese MPs or state assemblymen in the cities, but we've also produced MPs in the interior areas. We've had Orang Ulu, we've had Bidayuh, and we've had Iban MPs coming from Keadilan. So there's that base there, you know, and obviously we can't abandon that base. But obviously, I mean, you know, it's a formidable challenge. We know how strong GPS is and all that, but it's still important because Keadilan, you know, we believe and we've proven ourselves to be a national multiracial party, national, you know, not Malaya, as some of them like to call it, but we are a national party. So I think it's important for us to take those issues seriously and make everyone understand why is it important to our brothers and sisters in Sabah and Sarawak.
Extending the conversation further, because you mentioned about Keadilan being a national party, and I'm sure other components within Pakatan Harapan are also national level parties. But we've seen even recently, as recent as the Sarawak elections, where Parti Sarawak Bersatu has starting to espouse that even opposition have to be locally based. And I wonder, that sort of message seems to be accepted by the locals. They're judging by the votes. How do Pakatan Harapan intend to overcome this particular, I would say, barrier? Is it a mental barrier or a message barrier? How does Keadilan respond to that?
I think communications is important. But I think what is important, I think, is you have to remember, I think it's very crucial, is that PH was the one who wanted to introduce the amendment on restoring the position of Sabah and Sarawak to the constitution.
During the 22 months.
Yes, during the 22 months. And, excuse me, it was GPS that at that time refused it because maybe they saw PH will be credited for that. When it was the Ismail Sabri administration and he wanted to introduce it, we could have easily, you know, said no again, but we actually supported it so that the two-thirds majority was achieved. So I think, you know, we want to show that we are genuine in this. And I think, you know, it is not an easy task, but I think if people can appreciate that, we've shown that we are able to really address the issues, then they will, you know, support us in elections. And I think one of the most crucial part why I was talking about that amendment is that sometimes it's best to be part of a national party, a Sarawakian, a Sabahan, who's part of a national party where the leader is either the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister, to be able to bring up these issues as opposed to, yes, GPS is powerful, but it's still a regional party. Right, so I think that is something that is very crucial to make things happen and to get the necessary reforms achieved.
All right, so Dara Nirazmi, we still have a lot more to talk about. We'll take a short break. We'll come back after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. Thank you for staying with us. I'm Hafiz Marzuki, and tonight on the show, we are speaking to Nik Nazmin Nik Ahmad. He is the Keadilan Vice President and also the incumbent MP for Setiawangsa. Let's continue our conversation about the whole landscape of national politics, and I would like to touch on the big Undi 18 vote, or rather the youth vote. And we all know that this time around, we'll be looking at between 5 million to 7 million new voters, some of them between 18 to 21, some of them entirely new voters. They've already reached the age to vote. How does Keadilan and Pakatan Harapan intend to approach this particular segment of voters? Because I would say it would be unwise to categorize them as a monolithic, or, you know, just what they all act the same way. And in fact, we have recent studies saying that there are some youth are even more conservative than their parents. Yeah. So how does Keadilan intend to approach that?
I agree with the assessment. You know, the danger is that people say, oh, you know, only 18 is coming in, so PH will win. Again, that's
fixed deposit.
It's a fixed deposit, and I think you know the problem is when you start to think of any voters as fixed deposit. But as you rightly said, it depends on the geography, it depends on the demography. So some youths are more liberal than others, some are more conservative than others, and so on and so forth. How do we approach them? Is first we have to be where they are. You know, they are on TikTok.
Among others.
Among others, right? They may be in Instagram, some of them. They may be on Twitter, maybe to a smaller segment of them. Not so much on Facebook. And certainly, not in front of the telly, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the traditional media.
Traditional media. So we have to be where they are. And secondly is that, you know, information is much more free. It's freely shared, freely accessed today as opposed to in the past. There's not much government control in reality, which is in a way good for us. But it also means that people are also actually watching more about cats jumping up and down or some silly memes or whatever as opposed to real
information.
Content, real information that affects their future. So I think, again, you know, we have to be able to get into, if you're talking about the TikTok language, you know, the FYP, basically the timeline.
Yeah.
So sometimes a lot of politicians are saying, oh, you know, I've got quite a decent number, but, you know, my question is always, who's watching it? You know, if it's me, if it's another party guy and all that, then you're not really reaching, you know, you might as well not be on TikTok. So that's the other challenge. And the most important part, how do you reach this only 18 cohort, is actually to be talking about the issues that matter to them. And the issues that matter to them, they will be, they are basically the COVID generation. You know, they probably took SPM attending, you know, how many, less than 2 years.
Yeah.
Certainly less than 2 years of school that we went through.
And right? Also the timing as
well. The timing and the quality of teaching, so on and so forth. So that's one, right? So the earlier generation, our generation, went into university knowing that, oh, going to university, it will pay off with a good job. You know, you get good grades in SPM, you go to university. You go to university, then you get a good job, you know? You buy a house, buy a car. Now, that sort of dream is shattered because you see that because you see there was a statistic, I can't remember how many, but a lot of youths do not want to go to university even when they are qualified.
Yep.
You know? And you can't blame them because it's not just, okay, we talk about people who, I don't know, you know, they graduate with a normal degree and they have to be, they are forced to sending food or
e-hailing
and all that. That's one. But you also have, you know, the when we had the stories about medical graduates who can't get jobs in government hospitals, right? Yep. Sure, I mean, the issue is complex, why we send so many people to do medicine and all that, but that's the, you know, if you're talking about 20 years ago, that's the cream of the cream in terms of profession.
They shouldn't be having any problems.
They shouldn't be having any problem, right? You want, if it's a smart kid, he or she will do medicine and, you know, they will get a good job, even if they don't go into private sector. So when you have that sort of situation, you have a generation that is not satisfied. They will not be satisfied with the status quo. And it's not just in Malaysia. You look at across the world, it's happening. But if we're talking about Malaysia, I think that's why we need to come up, as I said, the overall manifesto doesn't have to be so ambitious, but it has to be underpinned by 4 or 5 grand radical policies. And a lot of it has to address these youth because they want to find a way out. They want to that realization of a better life to be realized. So I think that is very crucial if we want to reach to the only 18. It's not so much race, it's not so much religion. But if we do not make that convincing argument, someone who takes an extreme racial line, they can exploit the fears, they can exploit this and say, oh, it's not happening because a certain race dominates business or because certain people do not want to give jobs or government is dominated by a certain race. And you see that in America, you know, you see that in Britain. So It can happen if we do not address that.
But you're talking about youth who actually cares or having problems, you know, having challenges they want to be solved. But in my conversation, my personal conversation, and also with my colleagues, there are a segment of 18 to 21-year-olds who does not have a problem, and they do not, I wouldn't, for a lack of a better word, care about, you know, they're doing fine. They have good internet. they stay with their parents. Everything is fine. How do Keadilan and Pakatan Harapan reach this group? How do we turn them into, you know, participating citizens if they, at first, they really don't care?
Well, I think the first, I think, is that we have to claim credit where it's due, in the sense that all this automatic voting, all this Undi 18, it only happened because PH won, right? And I think, you know, the whole value of people's vote, you know, some people say, why is my vote valuable? You know, suddenly I get the same old people as ministers all over again, right? after the Sheraton move. But let me say this, you know, if you did not vote for change in 2018, you will not see Datuk Sri Najib going to jail. And I think that is an achievement that not many countries, you know, we like to talk about Singapore, for example. Mm-hmm. I have to say that in this issue, obviously they will say that, you know, they're clean.
Yeah.
Let's not go there. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, for a country to imprison its former prime minister, it's something remarkable. And that was only possible because of what the voters did. So what I'm saying is, they should play that role in the democracy. And, you know, there are two narratives out there, although both talk about multiracialism, moderation, but one is underpinned by sort of a more racial argument beneath. Right? We know that. So, do you want that vision or do you want this vision? Do you want a government that, you know, basically the same old people? Mm-hmm. Or do you want a government that, yes, we do have a mix of experienced people, like Datuk Sri Anwar Ibrahim, Lim Guan Eng, but we also have a cohort that are younger, people like Anthony Loh, Rafizi Ramli, Nurul Izzah, you know, which are really fresh in many ways. So if they think that Malaysia can do better, and if only a different vision is implemented in the country, then they should vote for Pakatan Harapan. And now we have the anti-hopping law, mm-hmm. right? So I think that is, again, something, an important achievement to provide that stability to the government, so that we, whatever happened in Sheraton in 2020 will not be repeated.
Moving on from the young and the youth to something that Keadilan recently announced, more specifically the announcement made by Deputy President Rafizi Ramli, where he announced that, you know, if you send your CVs, you know, for considerations to be candidates. I'm wondering, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers out there are also wondering, how is the process going on, and how many candidates can you come this way? Because as we all know, politics in Malaysia is all about going through your AJK kawasan and then slowly rising up the ranks to Ketua Bahagian and everything. But this has totally changed how seat allocations in terms of choosing candidates. How's the process has been going on?
I thought you were saying that you submitted a form.
Oh, no.
But anyway, seriously, I think how it was quite, impressive. I mean, I'm part of the committee that goes through the candidates' names and then we propose it for the president. And the names that we saw, you know, were really, really impressive. And we had some people who were party members that we were not aware about. And they're high-ranking professionals working here, working abroad, working in the civil service. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that is commendable. The only unfortunate part is that, it's just election came too soon, right? If we had a longer time, then we could have gotten probably longer names and more names, and we could go through the process even more. We had 1,000 names, as I said, and we go through. But obviously, you know, the party also, you know, the different the state chapters, then the divisions, the cabangs, then you have the youth and the women's wing. They also submit the names, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to balance and see. And there are places where those who are the seasoned politicians will be put in place. And there will be places where fresh new faces will be put in place. As I said, keadilan has always been about balancing those things. Mm. You know, how people like Nurul Izzah, Amiruddin Syari, who's now Menteri Besar of Selangor, Chang Li Kang, another vice president, how we cut our teeth in politics was that we were asked to contest when we were in our 20s. And I was Naib Ketua Angkatan Muda. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite very junior in the mm-hmm. ranks, right? But party wanted good candidates, and the party pushed it through. You know, I know that there are some parties where the warlords are super mm-hmm. powerful and yeah. you cannot push new names inside. So I think it's about balancing that. And it's also about making the process more transparent. I can say that this is the first time that we have a proper, fair candidate selection process that's not factional. Mm-hmm. You know, the Azmin Ali era and whatnot. Now it's much more transparent. Everyone can see how it's done. And I think that's how it should be. I mean, I think candidate selection is an important part of reforming our party system. I mean, for all parties. Because if you don't have, if it's all about the watika mm-hmm. from one person and no process, mm-hmm. Then you see what's happening to UMNO, where one person can even hold the prime minister to ransom. Mm-hmm.
Just before we end the show, since you already mentioned about watika, will you be defending Setia Wangsa, or you'll be moving to a new seat, as you said?
I've expressed openly my intention, whether at public events, whether at party events, whether with party leadership, to Dato Sri Anwar, to Saudara Rafizi, that my intention is Setia Wangsa. If they ask me to give 3 seats that I want, I will say Setia Wangsa, Setia Wangsa and Setia Wangsa. But going back to your question, obviously the power lies with the president. So, you know, that is a due process that we have to go through, and I think we'll wait for that process. But I'm confident that, you know, I'll be able to contest there and to defend the seat.
All the best to you, Saudara Dick Nazmi. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this edition of Consider This. Stay tuned to Astro Awani for a lot more Malaysia Memilih content. I'm Hafiz Mansuki. Good night.